Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is California high-speed rail on track. According to California's High-Speed Rail Authority, the agency charged with planning, designing, building, and operating the project, the answer is a resounding yes. By 2029, the authority reports, the rail system will shuttle passengers between San Francisco and LA in under 3 hours at speeds of up to 200 miles per hour. Project supporters say the high-speed rail system will bring significant environmental and social benefits, boost economic development and productivity, and cost much less than constructing new highways and airport infrastructure to keep up with the population growth expected in the state. Critics question, however, whether the authority's cost estimates and financial models are reliable, whether the project's touted environmental benefits are realistic, and whether the state has the expertise, the political will, and the resources to complete what would be the largest public works project in California history. Joining me in studio to discuss these issues are Thea Selby, advisory board member of Californians for High Speed Rail, a nonprofit organization advocating for the state's successful construction of a viable, sustainable, and passenger-friendly high-speed rail system. Welcome, Thea.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And on the phone, we have Elizabeth Goldstein Alexis, co-founder of Californians Advocating Responsible Rail Design, a citizen network formed in response to community concerns about the high-speed rail project. The organization opposes the high-speed rail project as currently conceived. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
We also have on the phone Lou Thompson, chairman of the High-Speed Rail Peer Review Group, whose duty is to independently evaluate the California High-Speed Rail Authority's plans, assumptions, analyses, and estimates. Lou is also principal with Thompson, Galenson & Associates, which provides consulting assistance on transport strategy and policy worldwide. Welcome, Lou.
Thank you very much.
And finally, by phone, we have Ben Troposis, Northern California Regional Director for the California High-Speed Rail Authority. Ben previously served as the Transportation Policy Manager for the City of San Jose and the Chief Transportation Policy Advisor to the Mayor of San Jose. Welcome, Ben.
Well, thank you for having me.
We will ask you to join our conversation later in the hour to share your thoughts about high-speed rail in California. But to start, Ben Troposis, we have you on the line for the first few minutes of the program only, so let's start with you. Can you paint a picture for our listeners about what high-speed rail in California will look like as envisioned in the current plan?
Well, David, as it's outlined in our current business plan, the 2012 business plan, we envision a high-speed rail system comparable to any in the world that you can get on the train and at the Transbay Terminal in downtown San Francisco and take the train to L.A. Union Station in Anaheim in under 3 hours. A system that gives us the opportunity to connect Central Valley cities, which have really been isolated in large part and been very much an island in California, separate from the population centers in both Northern and Southern California, and connect those cities, places like Fresno and Bakersfield and Palmdale, and connect them to the commerce and the opportunities available both in Northern and Southern California, and really shrink the state in many ways and establish the kind of statewide mobility that we don't currently enjoy.
Let me ask you about the latest setback for the plan, which was the Superior Court ruling halting construction beginning. Can you tell us about that ruling? What did it say, and what is the High Speed Rail Authority's reaction to that ruling?
Well, in summary, there were two rulings that Judge Michael Kinney put forth late last year, one which addressed part of an existing lawsuit brought by several farmers in the Central Valley along with Kings County, which was a party to that suit, that questioned the 2011 funding plan for the project. And the second ruling focused on the validation effort for the sale of bonds to support the funding of the project. Now, the news on those decisions really is that the state of California, the governor's administration, Governor Brown and his administration, the Department of Finance, the state treasurer, have filed a suit on behalf of the state of California, excuse me, seeking to overturn those rulings because of the potential impacts not just on high-speed rail, but on the state's ability to sell bonds for future infrastructure projects. So really, the state is taking the lead on that effort now. As you may know, the Supreme Court acted to remand that the case to the Third Appellate Court in Sacramento, and the appeals court is now considering whether or not to take that appeal forward, and we're waiting to hear.
And they'll be hearing that case on a very much expedited basis. In the meantime, are you standing still, or is there any way you can move forward while you await that appeals court ruling?
No, not at all, David. It's important to note that when the rulings came down late last year, that the judge, Judge Kenney, did not limit our ability to continue to move forward on the project. He didn't approve the plaintiff's contention that there should be a restraining order on the project. He didn't limit our ability to utilize the federal funds that were committed by Congress and the Obama administration. He didn't limit the work that the Tudor Perini team, the joint venture that is moving forward with the first construction section in the Central Valley, didn't prevent them from continuing their work forward. So the design and planning and initial steps toward construction of the first section of high-speed rail in the Central Valley is going forward, and planning on the remaining efforts, both remaining project sections, rather, both north and south, continues.
Talking about that initial Central Valley section, that has been quite controversial in some quarters, asking why in the world, when you're starting this, are you doing it so far away from the urban centers that it is looking to connect? Can you explain the decision-making process that went into that and what you think the public's reaction has been to that decision?
Well, David, I like to remind folks that when we built the national highway system, the initial construction was in Kansas, and that's about as in the middle as you can possibly get. Similarly, on a project as large as the statewide high-speed rail program, the opportunity to begin construction in the Central Valley was important for several reasons. First and foremost, it allows us to move more quickly on implementing the federal funding and getting that money on the ground and under construction, purchasing right-of-way, establishing the corridor, constructing the facility is much easier to do, will be much easier to accomplish in the Central Valley as opposed to the much more populated areas both north and south. We still have the worst unemployment in California, if not in many parts of the nation, in the Central Valley. Air quality is still among the worst certainly in California, if not the nation, in Central Valley. So the potential benefits to the Central Valley are compelling and certainly important for us to address sooner rather than later. And finally, that initial construction section will be the backbone of high-speed rail in California. It's a section that will be integral to the statewide system. It's not a temporary section until we get the remainder of the project constructed north and south. So this backbone will allow us to test and certify the operation of high-speed rail at 220 miles an hour through the Central Valley and ensure that the statewide system will function at the level that we expect. So there are several reasons for us focusing on the Central Valley, and it really is the logical place to start.
Ben, the governor remains as committed as ever to this project by all accounts. So moving forward, when will ground actually be broken, and is this on schedule to actually be completed with all the obstacles that have come up by 2029 as your most recent plan attests?
Well, David, as you are certainly aware, infrastructure projects of this sort face challenges constantly. As far back as the construction of the Golden Gate Bridge and the Bay Bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge was sued over 2,000 times, rather, and that was in the days well before the California Air Quality Act. So infrastructure projects of this size always face challenges. You are right that Governor Brown is the leading advocate for the project, and he's been steadfast in his support for high-speed rail from dating back to his first administration, and we believe certainly his support, legislative support that we have, and the where we are in terms of the implementation of the project and the stakeholder support that we receive from all of our partner agencies, agencies like the Capitol Quarters and the Altamont Quarter, Express, the San Joaquins, Metro in Los Angeles, all of our partner agencies who are looking very much forward to eventually connecting to future high-speed rail, allow us to maintain that momentum. Certainly, we will await eagerly the outcome of the appellate court action, but we have every confidence that the court will find in our favor and allow us to move forward. In addition,
so when would you actually break down ground in that case under your current thinking?
David, I don't have an exact date, but we expect to break ground very much in the first part of this year.
Okay. Ben, thank you so much for joining us. I know you have to run. We'll move on to our other guests. We really appreciate you being on City Visions.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. That was Ben Tripolis from the Northern California Regional Director of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. Lou Thompson, let's move to you next. You are chairman of the High-Speed Rail Peer Review Group. Can you talk a little bit about what that group does and who you report to?
Okay, thanks a lot. I think that's a good place for me to start. The peer review is an expert group created by the legislature, and we report to the legislature. Our job is to look at the reports and funding plans and any other issues on high-speed rail in California that we think need looking at. We are not paid, and we work by consensus. We have generally said that high-speed rail is a desirable part of a future transportation network for California because we don't think more of the past is going to work in the future. And there's a lot of high-speed rail experience around the world. The technology is reasonably well proven. The costs are known. It's not really rocket science in what's being proposed to do. But there are a lot of other issues facing the state, and the legislature has to make some hard choices, especially what priority to give high-speed rail as opposed to all of the other things that the state faces. We do not advocate for or against. I want to underline that. The legislature has a lot of people, advocates one way or the other. What they really need is somebody who helps them frame the issues as fairly as possible, so they can make the choices they want to make with a full appreciation of the issues. Let me just summarize a couple of things. One is that this is a typical mega project, only it's on steroids. It's the largest mega project I know of, certainly the largest the state has undertaken. It's only gotten started. There's no real experience yet in hand, and there are a lot of uncertainties in the cost and the scope and the schedule and the financial and economic outcomes. Could be good outcome, could also be very low end, and it's very hard to say right now exactly what's going to happen. Second, full financing is not in hand. This doesn't say, and we never said, that the legislature shouldn't go ahead, but they have to do this with their eyes open. They have to know what the risks of that are. Now, the Central Valley segment alone doesn't pose a huge risk, although it would be a shame if it stopped there. We could learn a lot, but there certainly is a risk of stopping there. The management challenge for the project is a major issue. The capability of the current organization isn't proven yet, and they're taking on a very, very large project. We do think that the blended system that's been proposed between San Jose and San Francisco is a good approach on the peninsula, and various versions of it on the south end are also appropriate. And they're fully consistent with the European high-speed rail project experience. We do need to define as soon as we can how the system will be owned and managed, whether it's owned publicly and operated publicly, or owned publicly and operated privately. This is all going to affect the financing plan that they need to develop. And I have a final caveat. We take no position on legal issues. This is the issue. We get to sit and watch this one, and we don't have to contribute to that.
Right. You focus on the policy issues.
We focus on the policy and along some of the technology issues and the economic and the financial issues, but we are not lawyers.
Okay, well, you touched on a lot of points that we'll be getting to through the rest of the hour, so we will definitely be circling back on those. But I want to now turn to Thea Selby with Californians for High Speed Rail. Thea, Tell us why your organization is such a strong proponent of moving forward with the high-speed rail in California.
So there are so many reasons that we believe that this is the best thing for California. Some of them are the general ones that Ben Tropos has already spoke about. This is good for the environment. It is good for the health of the people who are suffering from congestion in the inland California. It is good for jobs. There are jobs, many jobs that will be had as a result of this high-speed rail. It's cutting edge, like California, like we were with stem cell technology, as we were with Silicon Valley. And finally, hopefully, and Ben touched on this, it will reduce the two Californias, because there really are two. There's the inland and the coastal California. The coastal California's got great air. We've got great public transit. We've got these great jobs. Everything's going swimmingly. Inland, they have a lot of congestion. There are a lot of asthma problems from congestion, a lot of health problems. So we want to reduce that to Californians and make it back into one.
Elizabeth Goldstein Alexis with Californians Advocating Responsible Rail Design. You have a different take on this. Tell me your organization's views.
Well, our organization was, we're not like Lou's organization, but we were agnostic on the project generally. I personally had actually voted for it, and I think it's just over time that as we see more of it, that we become more concerned about it. It's one of these things that's great in concept, but the ability to execute really matters. And I think one thing we would throw out is that, you know, we keep hearing references to the Golden Gate Bridge or to the, you know, some big physical monument. Well, cutting edge in Silicon Valley is not about a piece of hardware. It's about the software. And, you know, this project was sort of conceived, you know, somebody drew a line on a map, but, you know, nobody, and there was a scathing report actually on Caltrans last week. In 40 years, nobody in California has really stepped back and said, what is our vision for transportation? And it's not just high-speed rail. I mean, that might be a piece of the puzzle, but until you understand what your vision is, it's really unlikely that you got lucky and put high-speed rail where it makes any sense.
Let me ask you about the costs, because I think it's very interesting that you voted for this when it first came out, but now are leading an advocacy group with serious concerns about the project. Are the ballooning costs one of the main reasons that you have kind of changed your mind on it?
Well, I wouldn't call them ballooning costs, and I think because that's a misnomer. That implies that the costs were low, and then things happened, and then they went higher. The costs were probably, you know, since probably 2004 or 5, were in the neighborhood that they are now. But what we figured out is there was a basic dishonesty when they went to the voters. And I think that's part of our concern, is that when you have a project which is based upon a really big lie, right? You set up safeguards. You do everything. You make promises to the voters. In this case, you asked them for $10 billion, which is a pretty serious commitment. But then you said it's going to be, you know, we can finish this thing with other people's money, and people signed on for that. And now it turns out that it's not just going to be other people's money. It's going to be Californians' money, and you know, now there's a proposal to use the cap and trade money. So
right.
While this might in the long term have a benefit for greenhouse gases, in the short term, I mean, this definitely is kicking up dust in the Central Valley. It's definitely doing a lot of other things, and if you're taking money away from projects that would directly go to work on these issues today, I mean, you have to be sure that you've signed up for it. And you know, this goes back to the stuff that Lou Thompson was talking about. And, you know, the legislature, I'm not sure it fully understands what they're in for.
Let's take a quick station break, and then, Thea Selby, I want to get your response to that. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing high-speed rail in California with our guests, Thea Selby, Advisory Board Member of Californians for High-Speed Rail, Elizabeth Goldstein Alexis, co-founder of Californians Advocating Responsible Rail Design, and Lou Thompson, chairman of the High Speed Rail Peer Review Group. We were joined earlier by Ben Tropos, Northern California Regional Director for the California High Speed Rail Authority. Thea, what is your response to Elizabeth's comments?
So, first of all, I want to point out something that probably a lot of us don't know, which is that BART would have cost $15 billion in today's money. At the time, it was called a boondoggle. $15 billion. I hope I said that right. It was called a boondoggle at its time. Nobody will ride it. We don't need it. Its biggest problem today is overcapacity. There are too many people who want to ride BART. Secondly, as far as, you know, what will happen with the greenhouse gases and how will this be effective high-speed rail, there are early benefits even now as we speak. For example, there are changes in city plans that are happening as a result of high-speed rail. Fresno has approved plans that call for infill and for dense development. That would not have happened if not for the plans of high-speed rail going through Fresno. Electrification of Caltrain, that would not be moving forward if not for high-speed rail. That's going to be happening and give us 18,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide annually. And finally, we have all of this connector transportation that's happening as a result of high-speed rail, and we'll be able to use the cap-and-trade funds to do that, which will then free up some other funds to be used later on.
Lou, let's turn to you and start to tease out some of the issues you talked about, starting about costs. You said that the full funding for this clearly has not been identified. How much has been identified, and what are the options for getting the remaining money that's going to be needed?
Well, actually, about $3 billion of federal money has been identified. That was to be matched with about $3 billion of state money, but the total bond issue could be as much as $9 billion. I believe that bond issue requires matching, so it would, in principle, could be as high as $18 billion if it's fully matched. That's the problem is that there simply are no sources beyond the current federal programs at the federal level, and there are no good sources at the state level other than possibly the carbon trading program. So that as of now, going beyond the Central Valley, there are no stable programs in place that anyone can depend on. Now, of course, you can assume that such programs will exist. You can propose them, but there is a risk. There's certainly a risk that they will not be funded. When Ben Trapusa said that they started the Interstate Highway Program in Kansas, what he didn't say was that there was, in fact, a stable funding program for the entire Interstate Highway Program in place at that time. They did have to increase the amount of money because costs went up, but the fact was that there was a federal program that 90%, the states had to fund 10%, but 90% of the funding for the Interstate Highway Program was in place at the very beginning. That's not true here, and we are not saying that the legislature should not take that risk, but we just want to make sure that the risk and the nature of the risk and what happens if it doesn't succeed, we want to make sure that's on the table.
How much more is needed, Lou, to complete this as originally envisioned?
That depends on which business plan you look at, and it also depends on your assessment of the uncertainty of any estimate as of today. The authority's latest business plan, and I haven't seen the 2014 business plan, but the 2012 revised business plan said something around $64 billion. The earlier version of that 2012 business plan had a number of in the 90 billions, but they were able to reduce that, particularly by adopting the blended system plan rather than a four-track high-speed railway from San Jose to San Francisco. But again,
and by blending, Lou, you mean using some existing tracks like the Caltrain tracks here in Northern California.
Multiple use of the existing Caltrain tracks by several different users. This is a good way of reducing the environmental impact of the system and making better use of what we have right now.
Let me follow up on the cap and trade issue, because what our guests are referring to, for those who aren't aware, is that Governor Brown, giving the funding issues, has proposed using some money that had been earmarked for cap and trade for high-speed rail, with the argument that there are going to be significant long-term environmental benefits. Lou, is that a valid argument in your estimation?
Well, it is in one sense, but it only when it's taken in perspective. High-speed rail in the short run probably will not save much energy, but there have been good studies in the long run that say high-speed rail will, in fact, save some carbon emissions. The question is whether this is the best way to spend money to save carbon emissions. My guess is that if the program were viewed solely on the issue of saving carbon emissions, that it wouldn't pass muster. There are other programs that one can think of that would save a lot more carbon per dollar invested. Of course, there are other benefits, including transportation savings, including reduced accidents, reduced congestion, a lot of other things, all that have to be taken into account.
Elizabeth, how does the cap and trade argument using those funds sit with you?
Well, the concern that environmentalists have had, and I think some people in the legislature, are that just, you know, for people who are not aware of this, cap and trade as a revenue source was not actually part of the original 2006 legislation that established a hard and firm cap on carbon emissions in 2020 for California. And so there have been some questions about the legality, and it looks like it will be a fairly good money raiser. Maybe not as much as people thought, because it looks like the prices will be on the low end of the auctions. But California ended up keeping a lot of the permits for itself and will be selling them in the market. And so it was just in November, I think, that a ruling was issued which said that it will be legal for California to do that, that this is not a tax. But part of that is going to be a requirement that the money is really, really tightly linked to the purpose of the law, which is to reduce emissions by 2020. And high-speed rail has been trying to say that they're doing that, but it's pretty clear that there's a high emissions related to construction of high-speed rail or anything like this. And high-speed rail has promised to mitigate what they're calling the direct impacts of that, and that's like the trucks that will be driving to the site to do the construction. But what they haven't even calculated, and this is most of the cost of any new system like this, which is why we have to take it seriously, is all the concrete and the steel and everything. So those numbers haven't even been quantified, but when people have looked at the life cycle, I mean, it's a big chunk, and you have to run the system well to make that back in the future, which is why our concerns are about the capacity of this agency. And you know, I think the issues that the peer review group has pointed out, like they haven't even really figured out, is this who would run this system and who would it be run for and by? Would it be something designed to get a lot of ridership, but it'll, you know, get as many people on but not make that much money? Or is it going to be a for-profit? And that calculus really matters.
Thea Selby, your views, particularly on the cap-and-trade issue.
Yeah, well, the first thing that I think we should sort of step back a moment and just remember that 38% of greenhouse gases come from transportation. And that's why it is the single largest contributor to greenhouse gases is transportation. And so one of the reasons that it's such a good idea to use cap and trade funds for that is because clearly it will reduce the amount of cars that will be on the road when we use it for high-speed rail. It will be upgrading and modernizing transportation immediately, things like Caltrain electrification, which is so important. And really what we're looking at is there's $250 million of the cap and trade funds that are going to be put towards high-speed rail, and that's 19% of the total cap and trade. So actually it's not all of the cap and trade funds that would be used that way. But I do want to just talk just briefly about, and I feel like this gets missed a lot when we talk about high-speed rail, and that's kind of, you know, why do we want to do this in the first place, you know? And you know, when people did Paris to London, when they did the Channel, air trips were cut in half. When they did the train from Madrid to Barcelona, trips by airplane again were cut by a third. 80% of New York to D.C. is on Amtrak Acela. So there are almost one in every five flights out of LAX are some sort of commuter trip. And I don't know about you, but I hate flying from LAX to San Francisco. It's a truly horrible way. It's uncomfortable, it's unpleasant, and it's bad for the environment. So again, I think we do have to step back when it comes to cap and trade and looking at a good use of it. This is a very good use of it for California.
You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing high-speed rail in California with our guests, Thea Selby of Californians for High-Speed Rail, Elizabeth Goldstein Alexis of Californians Advocating Responsible Rail Design, and Lou Thompson, chairman of the High-Speed Rail Peer Review Group. We were joined earlier by Ben Troposis, Northern California Regional Director for the California High-Speed Rail Authority. We now invite you to call in with your questions and comments. Tell us what you think about high-speed rail. Would you take a high-speed train to L.A.? Are you concerned about the cost of the program? Do you think California has the political will to see this project to completion? We want to hear from you. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions917@gmail.com. That's cityvisions917@gmail.com. Let's go to the phones. We have Greg from Mountain View on line one. Greg, welcome to City Visions.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So I was curious if you guys could discuss a little bit the announcement of Hyperloop and how it might affect one way or the other the decisions of, like, high-speed rail in California.
So you're thinking about Hyperloop, which we'll have someone describe as an alternative to high-speed rail.
Yeah, or yes, it's a proposed, I think, solution. So Elon Musk, who's famous for various companies like PayPal and Tesla, he proposed a technical kind of solution to high-speed rail in California called Hyperloop, which I think he published maybe a month or two ago, open to the public. And he has aggressive claims about how it'll cost far less, it'll be far faster, you know, those kind of things. It'll be completed in a much shorter time frame. And I was wondering how that affected the decisions.
Lou Thompson, you are an international transportation expert. What do you have to say about this Hyperloop concept?
There have been versions of this for many, many years. I can remember when I first worked at the U.S. DOT, there was a proposal for something called a gravity vacuum train, which was in some ways very similar to the Hyperloop. My answer to this, obviously, Elon Musk, one has to be careful about arguing with him, but until I see the numbers that say how much this thing would really cost and how much it would cost to operate, I'm going to remain agnostic at best.
Okay, thank you. And Greg, thank you very much for your call. Thea Selby, you want to get in here?
I just wanted to say I don't know anything about Hyperloop. I'll start there. But I do like the idea of private investors potentially getting into the game in some way, shape, or form. And the thing about cap and trade as well is that if we do have an ongoing and steady monies that are available, when I was at the board meeting last month, there was a private investor there who said that he thought that there would be much more likely that private investors would come in when they see that ongoing support from the state. So I do think, you know, the question of where the money is going to come from is very important, and private investment may very well be a part of it.
Could I add a point to that?
Certainly, Lou.
Private investment, at the very most, will take only a portion of this project. There have been estimates, and I think, you know, consistent with the authority's own estimates, the state will have to pay roughly 70% or maybe a little more of the cost of the project, which is the cost of the infrastructure, and that will not be repaid by the private investment, by the private sector. The private sector may well buy rolling stock, they may well operate it as a business, and they may well make a payment to the state, but there should be no expectation that that payment will cover the infrastructure investment itself.
Yeah, this is Elizabeth. Our concerns are, you know, that private investment was promised to the legislature for two reasons. One, it was just a source of money, but the second one is that it would be an endorsement of the business plan. And we have, while people show up all the time saying if the state puts in a bunch of money, they might think about it, nobody has actually put in a dime so far. And the people that we've talked to have actually been scared off now because, you know, this is going back to the actual execution. You know, decision after decision that's made about routing and about technology and all these things are not ones that somebody who wanted to actually operate this and not require subsidies would make. And that's our concern, is like, what is the end game here? And, you know, it seems to be to get to an end game, which in and of itself doesn't always, you know, fulfill all our goals.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Let's go back to the phone lines now. We have Kathy from Menlo Park on line two. Kathy, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. I wanted to find out what the panel thought about the public's right and their right to have a viable segment built, a segment that is one without subsidy. That's why the courts ruled in the favor of the farmers, and that's what's not being done today. And I just would like to have some comment on that.
Thea, would you like to respond to Kathy?
Sure. I think that that's something that absolutely, you know, if we're going to stay within the bounds of Prop 1A, that's something that we'll need to do. And I am confident that the California High Speed Rail Authority is working on making sure that there is a segment that can run without subsidy, and that segment very well may be starting in the Central Valley.
This is Elizabeth. So I think the high speed rail has their latest plans are to try and convince the court that having Amtrak use the 100 or 130 miles that they're planning to construct in the Central Valley. I don't actually think the plan is that it wouldn't need a subsidy. And the question is, how do you build out something like this, something that's a big project, right? How do you do a good first bite, especially when you don't know if you're going to finish it? And that's been the question. I mean, I think the new business plan may have something like running high-speed rail from a town called Madera, which is actually a more logical place than where they were planning before because it meets up with the Amtrak trains, down to a city called Palmdale. And I just don't think there's any place in the world that you have a similar network or a similar route that makes money. I mean, high-speed rail is, it's not just taking regular trains and supersizing them or super turbo-charging them. I mean, it's a little bit like a souffle, right, rather than scrambled eggs. It doesn't always work, and you have to have the right ingredients. And so that's our concern, is that we're going to put all of our eggs, all of our carbon cap-and-trade money, all of our political will, everything into this one basket that may not pay off.
We've been talking a lot about the Central Valley, and we now have a caller from Bakersfield on the line. Bill, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
My concern is that I've been following this project for about 3 years now, and I really can't find any research that has evaluated the I-5 alignment. I mean, if the objective is to get people from Beta Basin, the most direct route is Los Angeles to San Francisco along the I-5. And I'm just concerned that that's been totally ignored.
Who would like to take that one?
I'll take that one. This is Elizabeth Alexis. So you're not mistaken. The state made a decision, I mean, 30 or 40 years ago when it wanted to put in a truck route between L.A. and San Francisco. It decided to put it through the west side of the Central Valley, the dry part of the valley, instead of the eastern side where Highway 99 and where most of the people in the valley live. And so there was a similar decision to be made about high-speed rail. And at that time, I mean, I don't think it was ever really taken seriously because it was put together by somebody who was representing Fresno, and the idea would be to give Fresno better service and better transportation links, which I think it's something that it does desperately need. The question is just if you step back and you're not just thinking about putting in one high-speed rail line, but you're thinking about a network, maybe you should think about an express down the I-5 and enhancing the existing service down that corridor. But it hasn't really been looked at since maybe the mid-90s.
Thea Selby?
Well, I think there are a couple of things here. One is that, again, we do infrastructure for a couple of reasons. One, it does have a multiplier effect, and when we spend, you know, a dollar producing some infrastructure, then there is some real income that depends on a lot of things, but it's anywhere between $2 and $4 of real income is produced. And if you're doing that along a group of cities that actually isn't doing that well economically, then that has a benefit. My understanding understanding also, and I wasn't around at this time, but my understanding is that there were a lot of people in Bakersfield, among other places, and I believe also Fresno and Merced, who really wanted the train, and when I mean people, I mean political, you know, electeds, who really wanted the train to go through the town. They may not feel that way now, but it was something, at least at the time, that they felt very strongly about. So when we are talking political will, and we are very, very fortunate that we have a governor who is going to be reelected, who is very supportive of high-speed rail, but certainly that's one of the reasons that it goes the way it does, in addition to the fact that it's going to be economically extremely beneficial to these towns.
You are listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing high-speed rail in California with our guests, Thea Selby of Californians for High-Speed Rail, Elizabeth Goldstein-Alexis of Californians Advocating Responsible Rail Design, and Lou Thompson, chairman of the High-Speed Rail Peer Review Group. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. Tell us what you think about high-speed rail. The number to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions917@gmail.com. And I'd like to go to one of those emails. This is from Nicholas, who writes, "I am a train enthusiast and can't wait to ride the train if implemented. What is the projected cost of a round-trip ticket, and how will the train compete with airlines?" Lou, what can you tell us about this?
Well, I don't know that I have the absolute number. I know that what the forecasts were based on was about 75%, 70% of the cost of an airline ticket. They thought that with that number that they would attract a lot of demand from airlines and also from automobiles. The absolute number, I don't know.
And how do they come up with the ridership estimates? I mean, you're talking about something that doesn't exist. If you ask people if they would take something, you know, I guess in the, it's called Greenfield, it's something that creating a new service that doesn't exist, how can you possibly get accurate numbers when people don't even know what they want because they can't conceive of having this option, really?
Well, I think I should defer to Elizabeth in 1 minute, but I do want to say that one of the points that we have made is that Greenfield estimates, that is, demand estimate for something that doesn't exist now, has inherently a lot higher uncertainty of the outcome of the estimate than you do when you make a brownfield estimate or an estimate where you already have existing service. You already know what it is, and the question is, how much will that increase if we improve the service? To the best of my knowledge, except, I'm trying to think of a good exception, all of the European, all of the Asian high-speed rail forecasts have been brownfield. That is, there was an existing service. They already knew what the demand was, and the question was, how much would it improve if they improved the service? California is different because we don't have, for the most part, we don't have any rail service. We certainly don't have anything like a connection between San Francisco and Los Angeles. So the demand models have to be viewed with a lot more caution than you would something where you could take a pencil and a piece of paper, look at the existing demand, and then look at what your forecasts were. Now I'll hand it over to Elizabeth.
Yes, please, Elizabeth.
Yeah, so I'm an economist by training, and I've spent a fair amount of time looking at the high-speed rails ridership models, which were, I would say, extremely optimistic at the beginning. And, we've had some criticism and brought in some other people, and the numbers have sort of come down over the years. And it is difficult when you have something brand new. And just like you said, when you ask somebody, will you take the train, what you actually find in a case like this is everybody says yes. Just like if you ask them if they're going to go to the gym this year, you know, more than they did last year, everybody says yes, because it's like the good thing to do. So it is really a technical challenge to take those numbers and put them back into reality. On the other hand, it's also hard to forecast how many people will just take a trip because there's this great new way to travel. So it does cut both ways. I think the best way to do this is to look at other systems around the world, look at existing transportation markets, and that's where we get very concerned about the Central Valley demand. So right now between L.A. and San Francisco, which I do think if done correctly would be a great high-speed rail market. You have about 8 million people a year who travel between the two on a plane, and then about 8 million a year who drive. And high-speed rail will, for those people where there is a plane, if you wanted to get there in a hurry in California, we have such great air service between so many different airports and at really a very reasonable cost that you're going to fly. So that's your core market. So you're going to get some percentage of those 8 million. Then you'll get a much smaller percentage of the 8 million who are driving. A lot of those people might be four people in a car going to Disneyland. And then the third group of people, though, are the people who wouldn't have taken a trip at all. And that's the part where economic, you know, interesting economic things happen. And this is just going back to the global warming issues, is that, you know, while that's very interesting, it's what we see is that most of the impact is going to be not through cars coming off the road, but you will lower demand for plane travel. Now, the issue is that when you go to the Central Valley, I mean, they have literally it's in the, like 100 people or something who travel between the Central Valley and either L.A. or the Bay Area every day by plane. And so when you have that, when you just don't have the kinds of industry that wants that kind of travel. So we would be very skeptical and very concerned about any of the forecasts that are coming out for travel between on high-speed rail at a higher cost, you know, $80 or $90 each way a ticket between the Central Valley and Los Angeles, for instance.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Thea, I know you want to respond quickly, though, because we do want to get to some more callers.
Yeah, I just had just a real quick thing. First of all, Lou, I have taken the train from San Francisco, I mean, actually from Emeryville to Bakersfield, so we do have at least a little bit of a train, and it is a fantastic experience, but rather slow. It takes about 6 hours, so 2 hours and 40 minutes would be a great improvement. And I just want to also say you're absolutely correct. I agree with both of you. These are estimates that we cannot know, and they could be much, much higher than we think they are.
George in San Francisco, welcome to City Visions.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to City Visions, George.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. In regard to the route of the proposed route, I think there's some rather low elevation points along the way. And I wonder if someone could reassure me that in 50 years that the system would not be threatened by sea rise or something.
Thea Selby, is this something your organization has looked into?
You know, I personally am not that familiar with that. I will say that I have asked that question and gotten a general response, which is that absolutely the California High-Speed Rail Authority is very much aware of this and taking it into account in their engineering. But maybe Lou would be a better person.
Before we go to Lou, Elizabeth, is your organization concerned about this particular aspect of the project?
I would say this is the one issue we're not so concerned about. There are I don't think the High-Speed Rail has actually looked at the rise in sea level per se. It does look very carefully at things like flood zones. So there's definitely an area in Gilroy which is very low. It has looked at areas that might be inundated if a dam broke, like I think it's like Isabella up near Bakersfield. I mean, we have much more basic concerns about the engineering of the system.
And Lou, would you agree with Elizabeth and Thea that George doesn't have to worry about this particular issue?
I do not think that ocean rising as a result of global warming is a threat to the high-speed rail.
Okay.
To the extent that it is, it would be much more serious in the peninsula between San Francisco and San Jose than it is in the Central Valley.
Right. Thank you very much for your call, George. Let's now go to TJ from Sunnyvale on line two. TJ, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I've been listening to the show with interest, and I'd like very much to hear the woman say that there's only a few people interested in taking this train, or likely interested in taking this train in places like Bakersfield and Fresno. Things like that. What has seemed to me to be an issue is, again, the route. It ought to really go along the I-5 corridor, and it should be more of a spine for California if it's to be done at all. Just do San Diego, Los Angeles, San Jose, Oakland, and Sacramento. Yeah. And if you want to get to San Francisco, just transfer at BART to in Oakland to get there.
Elizabeth, can you comment on that?
I would want to respond to this. So I absolutely don't want to say that people in the Central Valley are not interested in a train. I mean, they are taking the current Amtrak, and it's a very important piece of the transportation network. And for those of you who don't know, there's actually an incredible system of buses called thruway buses that meet up with Amtrak trains throughout the state that really do connect the furthest corners of California to the other furthest corners. And it is absolutely essential for a lot of people who don't have cars and who don't have other ways to get around. What I am just questioning is whether you have the market that you need. I mean, in high-speed rail is one of these things where it's got a high fixed cost. You have to every night you have to go out and inspect every single mile of every track. You have to close the system down for 6 hours every night. It has a very, very, very high fixed cost to operate. And so you have to be able to charge fairly high ticket prices. And just by looking at the existing transportation markets, it's just not clear if the market is there for high-speed, high-paying, high-end travel in the same way that it is clearly there from San Francisco to LA. So it's a question of how would you build out that network? I mean, I think we'd be very supportive of, you know, improving service all over the place. And so I think people would take the trains there. It's just a question of when you're looking for high speed rail to work, you really have to be under 3 hours. And in conjunction with the fact that it's now planning to share Caltrain tracks from San Jose to San Francisco, which on some level helps you save money, and we would argue that you might want to share tracks, but you might want to find a way to do it for less time. But since you've made that decision, you've got to speed the system up someplace else. And so it's more of a network design issue than saying that nobody, I mean, people clearly want to go places, right, who are in the Central Valley.
Thank you. A quick follow-up, though, is that, you know, obviously we're going to have tremendous transportation needs in the coming decades with the population growth here in California. I think all of our guests agree on that point. If not high-speed rail, Elizabeth, what would be your plan for addressing those needs in a way that you think would be more efficient and more cost-effective?
Well, I think it's a great question, because if it was a theoretical question, I mean, I think we could all agree on some kind of combination of, you know, in some places you probably do need more roads, in some places you want to enhance the public transit, you want buses, trains, everything, a whole mixture of things. But that's not how we actually do things in California. And so right, you know, as we speak, you know, the whole idea was that by doing high-speed rail in the Central Valley, you'd avoid having to expand the highway there. Well, since, you know, 2003, I mean, they've done a large portion, they've actually built now or are planning or going to build in the next couple of years most of the highways that this project was originally envisioned to avoid having to build. So, you know, if that was a choice, that would be an interesting question. But that's, I mean, until we get to the point where we actually have a plan, now that starts being interesting, right?
Okay, thanks, Elizabeth. Lou, I want to turn to you because of your expertise in high-speed rail in other countries. We often hear that President Obama said, we are behind the times here in the U.S. In Europe and Asia, there are efficient, effective high-speed rail systems. Why can't we do that there? Can you tell us about high-speed rail in the rest of the world and what parts of what they've learned there are relevant to us and what parts really aren't relevant?
Well, let's start with the primary part about high-speed rail in the rest of the world is that they started with an existing network that went from everywhere to everywhere. Second, they have much higher population density than we do, so the inherent ridership available for higher speed rail, let's not define it yet, is much higher there than it is here, and people are accustomed to using that. I guess the third thing is that they didn't have the automobile option that we have, and the airline option was also not as well developed because the distances aren't as far. So the demographics of high-speed rail or rail in general are much more favorable for rail in Europe and in much of Asia than they are in the United States. So the distances in the U.S. are so much longer and the population densities are so much lower that high-speed rail or indeed rail service at all is not the answer in many of the areas in the United States. we do have something like high-speed rail from Washington to New York to Boston, and in fact it does have pretty high proven demand. So it's not true that we don't have high-speed rail in the U.S. It's just that the way we've developed our system, especially based on our distances, is different from Europe. That's a legitimate difference, and to say that we should have high-speed rail just because Europe does or Japan does is really missing the point. The technology exists. That's not the problem. The problem is really economics, and where is it? Where does it make sense that the benefits of high-speed rail are worth the costs? Clearly, they are in many markets in Europe. It's less clear that they are in the United States. We have to be careful about how we spend our transportation money. You will have noticed that we don't have enough to maintain the highways that we have right now or the airports that we have right now. We have to be careful with the way we spend that money, and we can't make an automatic decision that high-speed rail is some kind of panacea. It is not. It has very specific applications, of which California may well be one. But it's not something that we wave the flag about and say we're behind on.
Lou, as we close out the program, could you just tell us what you foresee? What should our listeners look for in the months ahead to determine where high-speed rail is heading in California?
Well, obviously, the first question will be what the Court of Appeals says.
Right.
If they say this project shouldn't go forward because of the defects that Judge Kenney found legally, then it'll be a very difficult situation. If they clear it and allow it to go ahead, then I think we have a couple of years to look at the experience in the Central Valley and see how successful they are at managing, organizing, managing, and constructing what they're trying to do there, and whether we can see the follow-up by Caltrain on its electrification and the similar projects in Southern California. If we see at the end of a couple of years, 3 years, real success in those regards, then I think we'll have one set of questions. If we see real problems or real questions or real challenges that haven't been met, then we'll have a very different set of questions 2 to 3 years from now.
Elizabeth, a quick last word from you. What do you see happening going forward with high-speed rail in California?
I think I would echo what Lou said. I mean, there'll be a big point in the next month or two as the court cases come down. The federal government decides whether this is a go or no go. I mean, I think that's just a critical moment for the project. But that's not clear sailing, right? The project itself will have to prove itself. It does get over these hurdles.
Thea Selby, what's ahead?
So I want to go back to the question you asked, Elizabeth, about, you know, what is the solution? Because we're adding 12 million people in the next 30 years, and the cost to build freeways is more than double what the cost to build high-speed rail. And I'll just take you to the young people. I live in San Francisco, and young people don't drive anymore. They take public transit. They take buses. They take trains. They're comfortable in this way. Californians don't have to be anymore a car nation. They actually can and will, I think, embrace high-speed rail.
Thea, Elizabeth, Lou, thank you all very much for joining us this evening. That is City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight, again, were Thea Selby, advisory board member of Californians for High-Speed Rail, Elizabeth Goldstein, co-founder of Californians Advocating Responsible Rail Design, Lou Thompson, chairman of the High-Speed Rail Peer Review Group, and earlier, Ben Triposis, Northern California Regional Director for the California High-Speed Rail Authority. Thank you all for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Bob Summer. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. Join host Joseph Pache next Monday as we'll discuss the GRIP program at San Quentin, which is a terrific program. I suggest you tune in 1 week from tonight. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.